Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna on News Talk.
Yes, you can email the show aliveandkicking@newstalk.com or you will find me on Instagram. I'm at Claire McKenna Presents. Coming up this morning, Lorraine Keane on her own health journey and a decade of championing menopause talk. Grace Alice O'Shea on advocating for what you need and executive coach Doug Gordon on how to supercharge your life. So what kind of a health and wellness week did I have? Well, I feel like I'm out the other side of the madness. Honestly, since I came back from that week in Spain a month or so ago, it has been relentless. But I felt like I reached the finish line recently. There was one last big work meeting and then I got to just relax. And while my frazzled senses do grapple from time to time with doing nothing, ultimately it felt good. So my normal life is resuming over the next little while. Yes, there will be work and home life responsibilities, but I feel they're at more of a pace that I can manage with lots more opportunity to fit in the things I need to do, the classes I like to go to, meeting up with friends, getting out for a walk, perhaps a dip in the sea, and not as many new challenges, because new challenges are amazing. That's where the growth is, but that's where so much extra energy goes and it can exhaust us that little bit more. I'm lucky, I suppose, in the fact that I am a freelancer. So my weeks can change. I know that's not the same for everybody, but I think it's important that we lean into an ebb and flow of our life. So sometimes we're really going and we're trying lots of new things and we're doing a lot. And then we need to retreat and recharge a little bit. And I'm in that mode right now. And I've sent my book to the publishers ready for edits. So that was a huge thing off my list. My son is through first year, so that's another thing off the list. And I feel like I've stopped taking the housing market personally, and I am now optimistic that we will find one that is right for us. And I'm happy that that comes with a slowed down pace. You can email the show aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. Now, Lorraine Keane is a well-known broadcaster and a sustainability advocate, helping to raise thousands of euro for Breast Cancer Ireland through her Fashion Relief initiative. She's also been a trailblazer in the area of menopause, recently marking a decade of talking about this life chapter. And Lorraine joins me in studio now. Lorraine, you're very welcome.
Thank you so much. Lovely to be here.
You're marking 10 years of talking about menopause.
Yes, because when I started talking about my perimenopause, menopause experience a little over 10 years ago, nobody was talking about it. And it was probably the scariest thing I've ever done in my career, especially in our line of work, Claire, because whether we like it or not, the industry tends to be a little ageist towards women in particular. And a lot of my contemporaries are saying, are you mad, Lars? You know, you're just going to age yourself completely overnight. Because back then it was seen as somebody who was kind of past it, you know, old and decrepit in the last stage of life. But as we all know, we're living longer now. And that's why I just felt, you know, you're always talking about being a woman's woman and women supporting women and sharing and supporting each other. I don't embarrass easily. I've got five sisters and a brother. We're a large family of talkers. And I had suffered in silence for so long, not even knowing that I was in early perimenopause. So I thought, just do it. Like, just do it. Help, you know. And it's been probably it and Fashion Relief, which is a charity initiative I set up for Irish charities, have probably been the two things that I'm most proud of in my career.
And so you should be. And I think it is really important that we start speaking in a more positive way, particularly about aging, especially for women, because men don't seem to be held to the same account when it comes to getting older. They age like a fine wine, as we often say.
So they think.
Yeah. But I love how Asian societies look at menopause as being the second spring, because as women, so much is given to our menstrual cycle. If a family is something that happens for you or that you want to happen for you, so much of your time and energy is put into that.
Yes.
So then that settling of the hormones and that end of your life, it's a beginning of a new life where you can focus a bit more on yourself for a change.
It is. And they celebrate it. They have menopause parties in parts of Asia. And I love that. And it is something that we should look forward to. I'm certainly looking forward to it. And I suppose the reason I'm looking forward to it and not fearing it is because I'm always say armed and dangerous. I have the information. I've educated myself. Knowledge is key in all of these things. So I'm really looking forward to going through full menopause, coming out the other side and living my best life, because I'll have no periods, I'll have no period pains, I'll have no PMS, I'll have no anxiety about will the period arrive on a day it's not expected, I could be on stage, you know, all of these things that as women we've had to deal with our entire lives from puberty. And I'm really looking forward to being just somebody that doesn't have to carry any of those burdens anymore. And please God, after 55, live maybe another 30 years, 40 years, who knows?
Yeah, no sanitary products yes. in the supermarket trolley. Oh,
listen, just always having to think of your female health in that way, you know. And we've had to, as I say, do that our whole lives. So, yeah, we should be celebrating it. And I hope that from me coming out and talking about it, and so many amazing, brave women coming out and talking about it since and sharing their stories, I hope that we have broken the taboo. And it's not a stigma anymore. In fact, I kind of know that we have, because I went out on the streets of Dublin with my camera and microphone. It's on my Instagram, and interviewed women and men about perimenopause and menopause, and asked them, you know, have we broken the taboo? And I was so thrilled with the response, because each and every woman was so open about talking about it. They said that, yes, they weren't embarrassed or ashamed about it anymore. But again, key was that they knew so much about it. They were informed and educated, and that's empowering. You know, we need to be empowered as women, and the only way to do that is to not be ashamed and embarrassed. It is a natural life stage. We have five of them as women, from puberty to postmenopause, and this is just one of them. So, you know, I'm just like, no chance. There is no way I'm going to allow any shame to be attached with this. We can't help it. We didn't want all of these things. I said to some male friends the other night, and they were actually laughing, and they, in fairness, they agreed. Maybe they were afraid not to. But anyway, I said, you know, it's not fair. You know, at least you guys should have got one of the things that we have to do as women, you know. So if we maybe are the ones that carry the baby and give birth, then you should be the ones having the periods. Do you know what I mean? Like,
or the breastfeeding.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That would have been nice.
Just divided it up a little bit more equally. And they were all laughing, going, yeah, actually, yeah, I agree.
Maybe in the next lifetime you can organise that, Lorraine. And what were the symptoms that you started to experience early on?
So for me, it was disruptive sleep. Actually, was the first one. And we all now know how important sleep is, because it's just, you know, a day changer, a life changer, if you can get a good night's sleep. So disruptive sleep. And so I'd get up, you know, during the night 3 to 5 times, and then sometimes just decide, because of that, I'd go and use the bathroom, and then I'd come back to bed, and I'd, you know, be tossing and turning with lists in my head, as us women do, going over all the things that I need to do the next day. So woke up the next day and clearly tired, irritable, had little or no libido, low mood, low energy, getting anxious, you know, and that's not me. Just feeling very imbalanced in myself. I just didn't feel like me at all, Claire. And felt burnt out as well. I felt like I couldn't cope with a lot of things that I would have normally not even, you know, had a second thought about. And it wasn't till I actually went to a women's health talk in the Merrion Hotel, and I heard a panel of people speaking, and it just dawned on me that it was my hormones. And I was annoyed with myself at the time, because, you know, we're both journalists, that's our background, so we read a lot, news is our thing. And yet anytime I would see anything to do with menopause, peri or otherwise, I would just skip through. I would turn the page, or I would, you know, click through if it was online, because I just didn't feel like it was relevant to me, because I was in my late 30s. And then when I realised that's all it was, and it was something that I could help and manage, I was just annoyed at myself. You know, I was really cross that I was not educated in something that was going to affect me, was affecting me for the last few years, but was going to affect me for the next few years too. And that's when I decided, okay, I need to find the ways I can help myself. But because I was so young, I didn't want to do HRT, because I was in my late 30s and early 40s. And I then started looking into the kind of holistic approach. So I wanted to, which wouldn't have been me generally. I would have been the type of person, like, if you've got an illness, take a tablet. Just don't, you know, don't be a martyr in pain. But I just thought, no, because it's so early. And I then started looking at, as I say, lifestyle changes, which there are three, they're free. So you do the diet, nutrition, you do the exercise, the right type of exercise, and then the well-being bit is really important too. You know, slowing down, minding yourself, taking care of yourself, not trying to be all things to all people. And in the nutrition diet, even though I thought I'd a pretty healthy diet Monday to Thursday, kind of at the weekends all bets are off, I still knew that I couldn't possibly have all of the nutrients, vitamins, minerals in my diet every single day, for sure, because I'm not a nutritionist. So I decided to look at supplements, and that's when I started taking Clean Marine Menamin.
And everything is so interlinked, isn't it? When you're sleeping better, your food choices are better. When your food choices are better, you have more energy to do your exercise, you're in better form with your family, your relationships are better. So each one is, they're all interlinked. It's all like a little Venn diagram that's going on to make you feel a little bit more like yourself.
Yeah.
I'm interested to hear how good you are on the slowing down piece and not being all things to everyone, because you've a lot going on. You've your finger in lots of pies. I know you love your work. You love your family. You love being social. You love getting in the sea, travel. Like, there's a lot going on. So how do you find the times to slow down within that and mind yourself?
I've gotten better at saying no. And I'm kind of a, unfortunately, kind of a people pleaser, you know, and I love people and I love company. I'm not great on my own. You know, I don't really like my own company. I'm from a very large family. So I just try not to be all things to all people as much as I used to. And I'm very aware, because I put it to the test, I'm very aware that when I do overdo it, and I overstress that little pituitary gland that distributes all our hormones all over our body. When you're overstressed, overworked, you're not taking time to relax and mind yourself, it gets overstressed, overworked, and it distributes the hormones in an imbalanced way. So, you know, in the wrong quantities to the wrong areas of our body. And that's when you get symptoms, or the symptoms you have, they're compounded. So I have noticed the difference when I don't do that, when I don't take time. And that's why I'm just not going to let myself feel worse. You know, if you manage all those things and you're aware of the lifestyle changes, the whole exercise thing is hugely important too. I used to think, because my metabolism slowed down after 40 and I started putting on weight, eating the exact same foods that I would have up to that point, I thought, oh Jesus, I need to work harder. So I'd go out and be pounding the pavements after working all day and being busy and juggling. And all I was doing then was overstressing that little pituitary gland and making my symptoms worse. So I actually felt worse, and I still wasn't losing weight. So I started doing research into that area, and I found out that actually over 40, our bone mass, our muscle mass, our bone density decreases by 30 to 40% after the age of 40. So we need to be actually doing kind of slower exercise, more intense focused weight bearing exercise, so resistance training. So I swapped then to do Pilates, reformer Pilates, and working out in the gym or working out at home in my kitchen, even just doing the right kind of muscle kind of exercises to make sure that we look after our bone health and our muscle health, for not only now but for our future health as well. So, and I actually have a video on my Instagram doing all of those exercises that I do at home when I can't get out to the gym or I can't get out for a walk, if the weather's not good or whatever. So those kind of things. It's just about listening to your body and educating yourself, you know, like yourself. Like I've got podcasts that I've interviewed all the experts and all the different areas that we need to be aware of. And that's up on cleanmarine.ie or wherever you get your podcasts. It's just really important to get the information and to take the time to look after yourself, because you will feel and see the difference if you do that.
Well, you're the perfect poster girl for it. I have to say, you always glow. No matter where I meet you, in person or online, they're not filters, I promise you. She's here now glowing. And it does make a difference, because up until then, if we were talking about bone health, we were thinking of brittle bones and a kind of a, you know, an elderly lady and osteoporosis. Whereas now we're talking about looking after yourself now, and your future self will thank you. And you're looking at someone who's in the whole of her health, out doing so many brilliant things, but also minding herself at the centre.
Yeah, I had a little trip walking the dogs in a pair of runners last year and fractured my ankle. And immediately I thought, oh dear, you know, osteoporosis, because I hadn't had a DEXA scan. And it's one of those things that I would say on my talks to all the women, you know, over 40, over 50, we need to have a DEXA scan to get a baseline for our, where our bone health is at the moment as well. And of course, hadn't done it myself. And I thought, oh, there we go. So anyway, went in, got the DEXA scan, and thankfully I was fine. My bone health is good. But it just made me much more aware of, actually, Lorraine, you need to, you know, start to practice what you're preaching. And, you know, to have the right, again, the right nutrition and nutrients in your diet is not, you can't, you know, you can't be sure you're getting your omega-3 every single day. Like, you should be having three portions of oily fish, almonds, you know, nuts, all those kind of things in your diet every week. So it's just being aware of what's out there and being aware of what we need to not only be healthy now, but to live our best life, for like live longer, but live longer and stronger, you know?
Yeah.
I think that's really important. And sleep is hugely important as well. So I'd say to anybody that's, you know, having trouble sleeping, I find magnesium really, really good. And again, there's lots of great advice and tips up there. I've just invested in a new mattress that's heat regulation mattress, which has been amazing. And, you know, hot flushes were something that really, really causing me problems as a symptom that I've just really developed in the last couple of years. And again, it's just to know that there is help out there, there's support out there. And don't feel bad about minding yourself. You know, women are desperate. We're so good at looking after everybody else, you know, and we don't give it a second thought. But yet we feel bad about looking after ourselves, especially Irish women.
I totally agree with you. And the more you look after yourself, the better you can look after other people. If you want to find out more about everything Lorraine said, go to her Instagram at Lorraine Keane Official. Lorraine, thank you so, so much for coming on.
Thanks, Claire.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Now, Doug Gordon is a motivational speaker, a corporate trainer, and an executive and life coach. His book, Charge Yourself Up for Success, was a bestseller, and Doug Gordon joins me in studio now. Doug, you're very welcome.
Hi, Claire. Thanks for having me on the show.
So for you, what is the definition of success?
For me, it's really connecting to your heart self rather than your head self, and finding your true passion or love in life, and then getting there in any way you can.
And it sounds great, but it doesn't come without its challenges, does it? And I think people think it needs to be linear, but that's not necessarily true.
No, I have to say there is a big flick all the time between people have their kind of subconscious programming with this path that we learn from our parents, our preachers, our teachers and past relationships. And that kind of gives us a kind of a way of thinking, speaking and acting. And when we become a little bit more conscious, you sometimes then start to think in a different way and speak in a different way and act a different way. But the problem is you get two paths on every single choice that you make in life. And with the ego there still, you flip from one to another, back and forth. And it's about trying to keep on that conscious path so you make conscious, kind, loving decisions rather than flicking back onto that one and thinking about material things or money or whatever, if you know what I mean. You know, there's so many people that think they'll be happy when they get this and they'll be happy when they get that and they'll be happy when they get this and they're never happy. And I think I was a little bit like that. And when I got a sense of purpose, and I think the greatest gift that you can give to yourself is giving to others. And that for me is hundredfold more fulfilling than anything in terms of being able to see a change in someone else's life where you bring a smile to their face in some way or form.
Yeah, I mean, that is the mark of success, isn't it? That feeling of contentment and that what you're doing is enough and that you are enough. And that can come from being at home with your family. It doesn't necessarily have to be monetary. And yet we're so fixated on that, aren't we? It's the way we've set society up.
Yeah, I think materialistically, people always think they need to keep up with the Joneses. I've lived the five-star lifestyle. I've been on helicopters, private jets, all that kind of stuff. It's never made me happy. This morning I got up and I always try and have a 20-second hug with my partner, because heart to heart. And that starts the day with a bit of happiness. You know, gratitude for the small things in life. I believe that we're spiritual beings having this physical existence. And the greatest gifts that we can actually have is the five senses, the gift of being able to see the sun, to see the stars and someone that you love, the gift of being able to hear a child saying, Daddy or Mummy, I love you, the gift of taste of chocolate, the gift of a hug or a kiss, and the gift of the smell of a rose. And those are really, if we break gratitude down into the simple things in life like those, and really, truly, consciously be aware of those on a daily basis, I think your life will change massively.
You've also written a book, Charge Yourself Up for Success. So what do successful people have in common?
Well, I think one of the most important things is mindset. I have a little acronym in there, and it is make things happen. You know, whether it be make a good relationship, make success, make sales, whatever it is, it's about mindset in terms of making you yourself into the best possible state so that you can motivate yourself to be the best version of yourself. And then the people around you will naturally float that way as well. But then it is about actions. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, these great books like The Secret Book, you know, which talk about, you know, you can dream about it and write it down and be grateful, but you do need to take action. So it's all about, you know, these guys that I have dealt with and worked with. They are big action takers, and you know, they grasp opportunities as quickly as possible. But they're also great communicators, because you can be the most intelligent person in the room with the most amazing book or amazing idea, and if you can't communicate that effectively to other people, you could be the greatest seeker in the world. So action, communication, K is knowledge. And I always say in knowledge, it's about emotional intelligence, really. So it's about self-awareness, understanding what are your triggers, traumas, and parental programs, and how can you self-improve to become a better version of yourself? Because your vibe attracts your tribe, and your vibe is based on how you think, how you speak, and how you act. So if you change that to be more positive, more loving, more kind, you will attract more positive, loving, and kind people as well. Also, emotional intelligence is about, you know, it's self-awareness, but it's also about conscious communication. So speak for what you want and speak how you want to be spoken to, and you'll create much more positivity in life as well. And then also, I think in terms of knowledge, is finding a sense of purpose, finding that heartfelt sense of what do you love doing? What are you good at doing? What can you add value to people? Or what mess can you turn into a message to give it meaning, to help other people in some way or form, to give you direction in life and add goals towards that direction to give you a real sense of purpose. And then finally, E is energy. I mean, having worked in the investment world, I've employed hundreds of people, you know, PhDs, MBAs, many people like that. And it hasn't been them who've been the most successful. It's been the people who wake up in the morning and really want to make a difference and have a love for what they do, love for the people who work with, and love for the people they serve.
I met a friend recently. I mean, she's very successful. She's had a great career. But the industry is changing. So her job may be coming to an end. And she just feels a little bit stuck. She's middle-aged. Her relationship is also changing. I suppose her family dynamic is changing a little bit as her kids get a bit older. And she just really felt lost in many ways. And, you know, I'm always, you know, pumping people up and saying, come on, you can do anything you want to. I'm that kind of a person. But she was very much like, I don't know who I am anymore, and I don't know what I want. And I'm sure that's indicative of lots of people. I'm sure lots of people can relate to that. They want to take that leap. They want to grasp life, but they just don't know what it is that they want. What's your advice there?
Well, number one is make sure that you're connected to your heart self so that you're following a path from your heart, because that'll give you more energy. So I would say write down five things that you love doing, five things that you're good at doing, and five things that you can add value to people in some way or form, and find a match. And I always say, if I gave you a stage and you were 90 years of age and there was 10,000 people there and we were to beam it out to the 8 billion people on the planet, what would you talk about? What would you be most passionate about? What message or legacy would you like to leave? And then reverse engineer yourself back to where you are today and ask yourself, okay, what do I need to do? Who do I need to work with? Who do I need to model? What do I need to learn to be able to stand on that stage, give that speech, and leave that legacy? And that hopefully will give you direction. Or if you're still stuck, just have a look at the energetics of what you do now. As a, you know, as a mum, you're helping children and molding them into, you know, lovely human beings to go out into the world and add value to people. So actually, that's a real sense of purpose, because you're adding value to the kids and adding, they'll add value to the world. So it's about understanding what happens in your life, what can you utilize in your life, what skill sets have you got, and what direction you want to go. But it must be aligned to that heart self, that place of love, because then you'll wake up with a spring in your step every day and want to do it, rather than having to drag yourself out of bed and drag yourself into the office and stare at the screen going, what the bleep am I doing here? So that would be a good start. But I think we have these goals in front of us, and quite often things get in the way. And they can be ego, they can be fear, they can be self-doubt, they can be procrastination. And it's very important in a state of self-awareness to have a look at those goals, those blockages, those hurdles, and look at them in a state of self-awareness, but also acceptance and understand that they're in you. Because quite often what happens is people always blame others for this and that. And when we point the fingers, there's always three pointing back at us. So if we take responsibility for ourselves, our change and our self-awareness, then it's amazing how things happen and change around us as well. And it'll make it easier to go towards that those paths.
The book is called Charge Yourself Up for Success, Energizing Your Life, Work and Relationships. Doug Gordon, author and coach and speaker. Thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you, Claire. Thank you so much.
Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Now, just a warning that our next item may not be suitable for little ears. What happens when one partner wants sex more than the other, or when physical or emotional barriers can hold you back from the intimacy you want? Well, sex and intimacy specialist Grace Alice O'Shea joins us this morning to talk about the most common issues she sees, from a mismatched desire in long-term relationships to navigating sex with physiological challenges. Grace, you're very welcome.
Thanks so much.
So how common is that mismatch desire I touched on there in the introduction?
Yeah, it's very common. I would say it's probably the number one reason people come to me, either individually or as a couple. So basically a kind of, often things are fine at the beginning of a relationship. Their desire is very high for each other. They're probably having sex quite frequently and hopefully enjoying it. And then things can change as time goes on, and that can happen for lots of different reasons. So a lot of my work is basically trying to figure out what is the reason, what is happening for the couple at hand.
And can you give us an indication of some of them? Obviously, it's going to be different for every individual and every couple, but what's different at the start of a relationship, and why does that sort of fade as time goes by?
Yeah, well, as you said, there can be lots of different reasons. It totally depends on the people involved. But what I would see a lot is, like at the beginning, you know, we often call it the honeymoon phase, and the scientific term is limerence. So we're essentially creating a bond with this new person. And part of that is we want to be as close to them as possible. Maybe there's still some uncertainty, you know, do they like me as much as I like them? And that kind of uncertainty can lend itself to that desire, kind of essentially like a bit of sexual tension. And again, you want to be with them all the time, and it's all very exciting. And, you know, again, people are typically having a lot of sex at this point. And then what happened, I suppose, that I'll tell you the few things I see most often. One reason desire can drop off for one partner is that essentially, so what can happen is one partner might be enjoying it more than the other partner. They're just having maybe a more satisfying experience during sex. Maybe there's more focus on one partner than the other. Maybe one partner doesn't really know what they like, so doesn't know what to ask for. So essentially, there's a gap in pleasure. There's a gap in enjoyment. So the person who's having less pleasure is obviously going to crave it less. You know, it makes sense. And the other thing I would see a lot of is that as a relationship progresses, especially if you're living together, maybe you now have kids, essentially you're very, very busy, and sex mightn't happen spontaneously anymore as much. And we're kind of brought up with this idea that sex should always happen organically and spontaneously, and you don't need to plan it or put aside time for it. But in reality, sometimes we actually do. So what can happen is we're kind of sitting around waiting for the urge to take us when our lives are so busy that it just doesn't end up happening. It moves down the priority list. And, you know, the less intimate we get, the less we crave it then. You know, it becomes less of a part of our lives. So they're the kind of two main reasons. And I would also probably add as well that sometimes if one partner feels like they're doing a lot more, if they're doing more of the childcare, more of the housework, more of the emotional labor in a relationship, they kind of feel then that sex is just another thing they have to give to their partner. And there can be a resentment there, and they kind of check out basically and don't feel that desire.
So many avenues to go down and things to pick apart. I want to start with one question. Do you have to be having regular sex to have a healthy, happy relationship?
I suppose the short answer is technically no. Like, there are people who have a good relationship and sex isn't a big part of it, And that is a decision made by both people who are happy with it. It's not something I see very often, though. Like, usually people would want that sexual element in their relationship. So, like, technically it's possible, but for most people, they want a happy, fulfilling sex life. Now, when you say regular sex, that's kind of subjective, right? So some people come to me thinking, oh, we should be having sex 3 times a week. And I always say, I don't know where that figure comes from. I don't know why they're picking 3 times a week. But you don't have to be having sex multiple times a week to have a happy sex life. I work with couples who might have sex maybe 2 or 3 times a month, and they really enjoy it. They're really present for it. You know, they try different things. They're very connected, and they're perfectly happy with that. So it's not really about numbers, it's more how you feel about how often you're having sex and if you're enjoying it.
And obviously we've come a long way, but we do still have an overhang of shame and taboo around sex, don't we? That it is a very normal and natural human desire and urge, and it's okay to want to have it. I was very interested in what you're saying about it being mismatched and one person enjoying it more than the other. And this whole language we have around it being a duty, something you have to just tick off the to-do list, which isn't really the way we're supposed to be looking at it, is it? It's a mindset.
Of course. And a lot of people that come to me, and particularly women, have gotten to the point where they do feel sex is almost like an obligation, like it's something they just have to do. They're not doing it to get pleasure out of it or to feel really connected. They're not really doing it for themselves. They're doing it just to keep the relationship afloat. And in that case, you know, it's often not going to be very enjoyable if it feels like an obligation. I do think your point about shame, it's still so relevant. Like, we've come a long way, but it takes a long time to undo that intergenerational trauma around sex and shame in Ireland. And we're definitely getting there. But, you know, people come to me and they say, we can talk about anything in our relationship, anything, you name it, but sex is the one thing we struggle to communicate about. And I hear that over and over and over again. So there is definitely still shame and discomfort around it.
And obviously, I don't want to stick to just a heteronormative couple in this instance. Couples come in all different forms now, thankfully. But it does seem that women have a lot of work to do in this area, or to be supported more in this area, that it's women who feel more than men, that it's an obligation.
Well, that's what I find in my work, yes. And again, I'm going to make some statements here, and I'm going to say, you know, not all men, not all women, everyone is different. But the patterns that I would see and a lot of my colleagues would see, it's bigger than just sex. It's actually quite cultural, where women, and we know from research, women, even today, they're still doing more when it comes to childcare, household labour, emotional labour and relationships that I mentioned earlier. They are still carrying more, despite a lot of women also being employed and working. So it's a huge amount of stuff on their plate. And I think that's where the feeling of sex being a chore comes in often, is that women are just, they're just doing so much. And I'm not saying that men aren't, but it's just the patterns that a lot of couples can get into that are really hard to break out of then, and just to learn to do things differently. And also, I suppose, again, just going back to the shame around sex in Ireland, it was kind of targeted everyone. I mean, especially gay people, queer people as well, but particularly women and female sexuality. So even the women I work with who would say, Grace, I have no idea what I like. I've never even thought about what I like, you know, sometimes that's quite hard to hear, that they've never even thought about what do I enjoy, you know, what gives me pleasure. So therefore they can't communicate that to a partner then. Whereas I find with same sex couples, I just find the communication is a bit more open about sex, to be honest.
I mean, there's so much there. It really stirs my soul, and it's something I'd really love to talk about more. But I want to talk about how you help couples and where they begin to navigate through these challenges.
Yeah, so if the problem is that there is, again, a kind of difference in desire that is really becoming an issue, I suppose one big piece is figuring out maybe why that has happened. Like, desire and libido is impacted by so many things, and even physical things. It's impacted by tiredness, by stress, by illness, by becoming parents. And then sometimes it's psychological, it's physical, it's a lot of different bits mixed in. So the first step, I think, is just talking about how we got to this point. I also help couples unlearn the unhelpful stuff about, you know, sex has to be intercourse or penetration. It doesn't. Sex is about, basically, when we break it down, sex is touching each other's bodies in a way that feels pleasurable, in a way where you feel connected. That's what it is, essentially. So kind of moving away from those dated ideas that, you know, again, sex has to be penetrative, has to all happen spontaneously. If we're not doing it X amount of times, we're failing as a couple. Just a lot of unlearning. And then, again, I kind of have to figure out what the reasoning is before I can decide how to help them. But if for example, if someone in the couple, you know, again, feels resentful that sex is just something they have to give to their partner, that's it. Looking at what's happening outside the bedroom. Well, how can we build in more, you know, shared responsibilities, more support outside the bedroom? Even going on dates, little things like that, where you're seeing each other as lovers, as partners, not just as housemates or co-parents. I obviously do give tools and practices related to touch and pleasure and sex, but you'd be surprised how much of the work is actually about outside of the bedroom, what's happening outside of sex. And once those changes start to happen, it usually translates then into a better sex life, essentially.
I heard the term chore play recently and I absolutely loved it. Getting a bit of help around the house can work wonders for the relationship, among other things like communication, as you said, and true equality, you know, so that both people deserve pleasure in the bedroom and outside of the bedroom and are able to ask for what they need. I think it's really important. And I think that's what sort of ripples out when you can talk about intimacy in this way. It leads out into the rest of your life. Is that what you find with people, that once you start asking for these things, then you're able to ask for the job you like, the help you need, the support you need, more from your friendships, put up boundaries? This all falls under living a life where you lean into pleasure over constant discomfort or duty.
100%. And that's why I say, you know, sex isn't this issue to be dealt with separately, you know, as if it's this kind of completely like disparate topic over here, separate to our physical health, our mental health. It's all connected. And if you are able to advocate for yourself and your pleasure, because, you know, even the concept of pleasure, I think Irish people really struggle with pleasure, as in the idea of just doing something just because it feels good, not because it has a secondary reason, just because it feels good. I think sometimes we struggle with that and there can be guilt around that, especially again for parents and especially for mothers. But I totally agree. I think even if you take a really quick example of if women, say, are faking having an orgasm, which is something I hear a lot, when you do that, you're sending a deeper message to yourself. You're sending a message to your subconscious that your pleasure doesn't matter and that it's more important that you don't hurt your partner's feelings than you actually having a good time. And I'm not convinced that that message is just limited to the bedroom. I think that's a message you're carrying with you in other areas of your life, like you mentioned work there, for example. So I absolutely think it's all connected. It's all about that feeling of being worthy and being able to ask, as you said, for what we want, what we like. And that's another thing I work on, is just helping people basically figure out what they want and then how to ask for it, how to navigate those awkward discussions, but awkward but necessary discussions.
Yeah, I think when people hear the word pleasure, they get a little bit embarrassed and think that it is only to do with sex. But, you know, sitting and eating a nice meal can be pleasurable. Reading a book can be pleasurable. Spending time by yourself can be pleasurable. But quite often we just don't allow that, as you say, without an ulterior motive. I want to ask you as well, it is such powerful work that you do. You also speak out about vaginismus, which is something that impacted you personally. Can you tell us briefly about that before we wrap up? But I'll have to have you back again, Grace.
Yeah, of course. So for anyone that doesn't know, vaginismus is essentially a condition of the pelvic floor where usually, you know, if you're going to have sex and you're aroused, the muscles in the vagina relax to allow penetration to happen. That's how it's all supposed to work, ideally. But for a lot of women, and for a lot of different reasons, actually those muscles can tighten and tense. And it could be due to a fear of intimacy. It could be due to unhelpful sex education, which I think was the case in my life. And essentially, sex penetration can become either painful or sometimes impossible. So I actually discovered I had this condition when I was in my teens, and I got treatment in my early 20s, and thankfully the treatment worked. So now I help a lot of women who have vaginismus and different degrees of it. It's kind of like when your body just won't do what you want it to do. I often compare it a little bit to erectile dysfunction. It's not the exact same thing, but just helping, again, men and women empathize with each other that, you know, sometimes your body just doesn't do what you want it to do. And I truly believe that for a lot of women in Ireland who have vaginismus, I think a lot of it comes back to that intergenerational shame, a lack of pleasure-focused sex education. I was told just abstain from sex. I was told it was going to hurt. You know, you weren't taught about sex in a positive way. And going back further, it was worse and worse and worse, you know, from generation to generation, probably, the messages. So you absorb that as a girl, as a young person, and essentially your body kind of learns that, well, no, I don't want to do that then. You know, so your body's trying to protect you, but, you know, and you're trying to get it to stop protecting you, to relax. But look, vaginismus is very treatable, just to say that as well. Very, very treatable. It's usually a blend of like pelvic floor physio and maybe some psychotherapy or coaching that can really, really help. But it is treatable.
Yeah, but it's so interesting what you're saying, the connection between the psychological and the physiological. It is so important. And as I say, it is absolutely powerful work that you do. If you want to find out more about Grace's work, you can go to gracealice.com. She also hosts the podcast The G-Spot with Grace Alice, and she runs the landmark RSE and Me school program, as well as talking, like here, through Instagram and on Irish media. Grace, thank you so much. You'll have to come back and maybe we'll deal with, you know, more specific topics as and when they arise. But I think this is such an important topic because it feeds out far beyond what happens in the bedroom. But that's very important too. Thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you.
And you can find out more about Grace's work at gracealice.com. So that's it for Alive and Kicking for this week. My thanks to my producer, Marisa O'Sullivan. Rory Galvin was on podcasts, and Hugo De Silva Scott, who was on sound. I will see you next week.
Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna. Sunday morning at 8 on News Talk.